I think quite often we need to think a lot more deeply about what clients need and how we're attending to that and also kind of how that does interact with our ethical frames and all that kind of thing. I think, for example, if a client is going to ask at some point, can I have a hug? We should already know the answer to that question before they've asked it. Because what a client doesn't want is a shock. So I think what we really need to be thinking about is like, what are our boundaries? Do we know what our limitations are around that? Do we know how we're going to handle those questions?
Welcome to Good Enough Counsellors, the podcast for growing a private practice without the pressure to be perfect. I'm Josephine Hughes, counsellor and creator of Therapy Growth Group, helping you get the clients you want and create the practice of your dreams. In today's episode, I'm welcoming Erin Stevens. Erin is a therapist, supervisor, writer and trainer, living and working in West Yorkshire. As a therapist, Erin works primarily with people who have been harmed in previous therapy, a specialism developed over a number of years when it became apparent that there was a dearth of support and understanding for people who have experienced harm and that the conversation was still seen as a taboo in the profession. Erin works to raise awareness of the significantly increased rates of harm for those of marginalised identities at all levels of the therapy profession, and campaigns for justice for marginalised and minoritised people in the profession and beyond. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here, Erin. You're very welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Yeah, great. So I'm going to dive straight in. And Erin, I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about your own experience of harm in therapy and how it led you to become a therapist.
Yeah, of course. So when I first experienced therapy, I hadn't trained yet. I hadn't considered training. It was actually after I'd experienced a bereavement, I decided to seek some therapy support for the first time when I was in my sort of late 20s.
Yeah.
The first experience I had was quite obviously inappropriate. So I had a therapist who, in the very first session, talked about other clients. Kind of disparagingly talked about other clients, actually.
Oh, my goodness.
And was kind of quite unbounded and said things about people that I was talking about that didn't feel right. So I thought, oh, well, maybe I don't need therapy after all. So I went away and thought, right, I won't bother with that. Yeah. And that was just after one session. But then as the months went by, so this was after the death of my mother, I still wasn't coping. So I thought, right, I'm going to try again. Mm-hmm. And I met a therapist who at the time, for me, felt like a really good fit.
Yeah.
I felt comfortable, I felt safe to talk, and we did a lot of work at depth. And I became very attached to this therapist, which is part of my process. And at the time, I had no idea that you could become attached to a therapist. I had no idea that transference was a thing. I had no idea about any of this stuff. And so I went away and read about it. When I came back and said, look, this is happening, because of course all the reading you do tells you you need to bring this and talk to your therapist about it. So I thought, well, that's what I'll do.
Yeah.
And then when I did that, I found that my therapist wouldn't engage with it, wouldn't talk about it, had real kind of difficulties, really shut it down, basically, which was very hard and very rejecting for me and left me kind of stuck. Mm. And his behaviour was very kind of push-pull. And it's interesting because when I talk about a lot of the stuff that happened in the therapy, it's very difficult to put my finger on why it was so extremely harmful, the way he behaved towards me. Mm-hmm. And what happened after months and months of kind of a lot of relational difficulty and entanglement and a real feel of trappedness for me, because it felt like I couldn't leave because I was so attached.
Yeah,
I decided to take a break and seek some consultation from a different therapist just to kind of be able to talk through the transference, because I thought, well, if I can't talk through it with him, I'll talk through it with someone else.
Yeah.
And it was actually moving to that therapy, which was a really successful long-term therapy. Mm-hmm. It wasn't intended to be. It was intended to be a short-term consultation. But it was moving to that that made me realise what therapy was supposed to look like.
Wow, yeah.
And then it was only, just under 2 years later, when my first main therapist sent me a text at 2 in the morning.
Oh, goodness.
Telling me that he'd split up with his wife and asking me to contact him on his personal email, that I was able to kind of say, see, this is what I was talking about. This was the stuff that hadn't been articulable. Yeah. And I actually find that's a really common experience for people that have been harmed in therapy to, not to be texted at 2 o'clock in the morning necessarily, but to find it really difficult to articulate what it is that's happening, that's harmful. And it was only when I really had that clear illustration, this is what it is. Mm-hmm. Look, see, this is actually what was happening before, but it was more difficult to spot.
Yeah, it was more, maybe more subtle, that sort of thing. Yeah. So what was that experience like to actually, you know, to be able to say, yeah, actually, I have experienced harm? How did that impact you, do you think?
It was a bit of a relief to have, when that actually happened and I got, and I had like a clear kind of illustration of what had been so difficult for me to get over. I'd been spending 2 years in therapy getting over it at that point. And before that, when I first went to therapy with the current, the long-term therapy that I had, which lasted nearly 10 years, what I was really struck by was the lack of information around what people that have been harmed in therapy need from therapy. Because I felt as though, as wonderful as my therapist was, I felt as though he didn't really have a lot of experience with this issue.
Yeah.
And so I said, I know, I'll go and find him some literature that'll help him understand what, you know, what I need from a subsequent therapy. And what I found was the literature just didn't exist. And it was that point. And at that point, I'd been considering starting training. And it was at that point that I thought, this really needs to exist. You know, we need to be having these conversations.
And this is part of sort of what you've been doing ever since, really, isn't it? Is actually talking about harm in therapy. So how would you define harm in therapy?
I get asked this a lot, and I've done a lot of thinking about this, and there are various definitions, like in literature, and I understand that when people are sort of performing research and things like that, they probably need a fixed definition. But for me, it really is, and it feels very simple, but to me it really is what the client defines as harmful. Just as it would be if we were talking about a harmful romantic relationship. If a client came and said to us, my marriage was harmful, we wouldn't say, yes, but how are you defining harm? How do you know it's harmful? You know, we would say that is their experience. And so it's been very important to me to allow clients to step into that, you know, and it may be that for a while a client can't step into that and then eventually comes to the conclusion it's harmful, and that's fine too. A lot of the time people come to me with the question, was this harmful?
So you're really, in a sense, centering the client's experience in that definition of harm. What's sort of coming up for me here is how that maybe interacts with our complaints procedure, for example. Because that sort of sounds like, you know, so if we sort of completely center the client's experience in terms of definition of harm, if they were then to subsequently complain, is there any recourse for a therapist or the BACP or whoever to say, actually, it wasn't harmful? It's just a thought.
Well, I think this is where we need to separate harm and blame. So we can talk about an experience being harmful for a client, and that is the client's experience, and that's completely valid. And we can say a therapist did or didn't breach their ethical responsibilities. And to me, the complaints process is about determining whether a therapist breached their ethical responsibility to the client. It's not about determining whether or not the client experienced harm.
Right.
Because for me, that's up to the client. And that's kind of quite separate for me. Both can exist, and sometimes they don't both exist together.
I take your point. So when somebody, for example, could be harmed in therapy by perhaps being re-traumatised, for example, if you've got someone who's working with trauma, but they might be boundaried and everything. Or equally, you could have that lack of boundaries as what happened to you, which was an example of that sort of harmful relationship for you, wasn't it? So sort of separate things from what you're saying.
Yeah, and sometimes people, there can be people, especially that have had repeated harmful experiences of therapy, for whom therapy in and of itself is inherently harmful because it's stepping back into that traumatic environment.
Yeah.
And therefore therapy might not be appropriate for some people for that reason.
Yeah, because maybe it's talking therapy and that isn't what somebody needs at that point. So I know you've said that a lot of harm is nuanced and hard to spot, and it sort of sounds like for you, you did manage to sort of put a label on it when you went away and sort of investigated transference. But it can be hard to spot. What kind of behaviours or patterns do you think would fall into this idea of harm, into this grey area?
Well, obviously, I think it can really massively vary, because any relationship between therapist and client is going to be different to every other relationship between therapist and client. So obviously it's going to massively vary. But the things that really interest me, some of the dynamics that really interest me are around kind of relational harm. Mm-hmm. So it may be, often it's kind of how a therapist responds to kind of relational depth, how a therapist responds to whatever kind of relational needs coming up in the work. Sometimes that might be, as it was, well, my therapist managed to do both, but it can be the piece about stepping too much into that and becoming a kind of rescuer and kind of wanting to give love in a way that actually doesn't leave any space for the client. It can be withdrawing at a point where it's quite a common thing is around a disclosure of erotic transference or sexual feelings in the therapy. Mm-hmm. And the therapist might get frightened by that and step back in a way that's rejecting. And that can be a reenactment of something that's previously happened in a client. So there's lots of different dynamics that can occur around this. Quite often there can be a kind of a switch. So what's one thing that I see quite a lot is therapists who want to be able to offer things to clients. They want to be able to offer, you know, between session contact. They want to be able to offer this kind of space where we can talk about anything. And then at some point, if the therapist hasn't thought enough about what they're able to manage, it might become overwhelming for the therapist, at which point they pull back.
Yeah.
And that can be received as really punitive by clients.
Yeah.
And again, it can end up reenacting early dynamics and all those kinds of things that that can be really, really painful for clients and actually really avoidable too, if we just collaborate and think about how we manage our practice, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of thinking about what you can manage in advance, isn't it? And providing that stability, in a sense, of a safe container and not
consistency.
Suddenly chopping and changing as you go along. Because I think that can be a lot of the complaints that come up, isn't it? It's quite a lot around boundaries and shifting boundaries and, you know, people not really being sure exactly where they stand. So can something that feels good at the time, like that extra bit of time or some self-disclosure, can that still be harmful, do you think?
I think it can be, especially for when it ends up in that dynamic that I just described, where the therapist is doing this and they feel fine with it, and then things get more intense and suddenly the therapist doesn't feel fine with it and takes it back.
Mm.
And then it takes on this kind of punitive edge, or the therapist sometimes might just end the therapy abruptly straight away.
Yeah.
And if there's a kind of reenactment going on, sometimes there may be kind of stepping out of the therapist role and blaming the client and kind of forgetting that everything belongs in the room and everything's part of the therapy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing something like harsh feedback from a client, that is still part of the therapy, and it's not kind of extrinsic to the therapy. So if a client is bringing difficult feelings towards a therapist into the room, it's just a matter of staying with that. It's a matter of being able to kind of navigate that as part of the work. So it's interesting you should mention time boundaries, because that actually did come up in my first harmful, well, my main harmful experience.
Mm.
Because he did used to finish sessions whenever. So like we had 60-minute session. It may be 80 minutes. It may be an hour and 20. It could be whatever. However much time he had, he enjoyed my company. You know, we would just go on. And at the time, of course, I really liked that, because I wanted to spend more time with him. And I just remember this one session, him saying, oh, we have to stop at 60 today because I've got to do something.
Yeah.
And just how painful that was for me.
Yeah.
And what I realised in that is that when we agree a finish time, as all my subsequent therapists have been, and we stick to it, I experience power in that. I experience some agency because I've agreed that. That's what I've agreed with the therapist.
Mm.
But if I'm just letting the therapist decide when we're going to finish, I don't really have agency in that. Of course, I could decide to finish sooner too, but I'm probably not going to if I'm attached.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. It's that client autonomy, isn't it? That, like you say, they've got agency. And sort of like, I think that really brings us up to this idea of power in the therapy room as well. Because that's sort of what came up for me when you were telling me about that experience with your therapist. There is this power imbalance, isn't there? Because you hadn't had a lot of therapy before, you just had that one session before, is that you sort of relied on him in a sense to lead the therapy, to be the therapist. And there's that sort of power imbalance, isn't there? And that you go into it not really knowing what therapy is supposed to be. And would you agree that makes it harder for people to challenge the therapist?
I think it really does, because I think often clients assume that they're wrong if they're having difficult feelings about it. And quite often when therapy goes wrong, clients internalize a sense that they're bad at therapy or that they've done it wrong and all those kinds of things. And actually, certainly in my case, and it's something that I've heard about more than once, the more I did learn about therapy, because I'm the kind of person that will just go away and learn things, the more I did learn about therapy, I think the more threatening that was for the therapist.
Mm.
And that became a really contentious and difficult part of the relationship.
Really?
And so that, and I think that really was about power. And of course, it was never discussed in those terms.
Yeah.
But I think there is a comfort for therapists sometimes in being in that position of authority, even if we're not conscious of it. I think there is a comfort about it. And it's the reason why when therapists go to therapy, they sometimes experience a different response from the therapist than they would if they weren't disclosing that they were a therapist.
Yeah. In some ways, you know, we can sort of take comfort if we're not feeling very confident. We take comfort in the fact that we've got our training, that we're the people with the knowledge, with the experts in the room or whatever. And if that's where we're coming from, there can quite often be that sense of wanting to protect our identity within that sense and sort of resisting the other person.
And I actually think that's really natural.
Yeah.
I think it's a really natural thing. And I think if that comes up for a therapist, that's not a wrong thing to come up.
Mm.
That's just something to notice and also not to make the client's problem. That's the line. It's like, what do I do with this? This feeling's coming up.
Yeah.
This client knows a lot about therapy and knows a lot about what I'm doing.
Yeah.
How do I manage that for myself?
Yeah. Because there's something coming up for me here about sort of relational depth, that it's sort of like using that power in a sense, that power imbalance, almost in a way to keep a gap between the two of you, rather than it being co-constructed, I suppose, the dialogue. Yeah.
Really. It's really funny though, because I think we can also do the opposite and kind of really run from power.
Yeah.
You know, we can say, oh, I really want this relationship to be equal, or this relationship is equal because I've decided it is, which is also kind of a power move, you know, and that there is no power imbalance because I don't think that there should be. But actually, sometimes the power can be a really important part of the therapy dynamic. Like my therapist once said to me, my long-term therapist that I worked really well with, he once said to me, I do recognise that there's a power imbalance, and it's a kind of unfortunate thing because it would be better if there wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, on the contrary, you're one of the first people in my life who's had power over me and has never used it for any nefarious means.
Yeah.
And never used it for your own
sort of gratification. Ends. Yeah.
Yeah. And so can you understand the therapeutic benefit of that for me?
Mm-hmm.
That I've been in this relationship with this power imbalance and felt safe.
Mm.
And he was like, oh yeah, actually, no, you mentioned it. So actually, I think the power's really important.
Mm.
And I think, like, we mustn't covet it. We mustn't misuse it. We mustn't hold on to it tightly and not want to let it go. And we also mustn't run from it and wish we didn't have it or pretend we don't have it, because it is there and it just needs holding, I think. Mm-hmm.
And it's where it's how it's held in a sense, isn't it? Actually, how you're sort of working with it. So another sort of area I'm sort of quite interested in is this idea, I'm sure this is something you're very passionate about, is this idea of cultural misattunement. You know, that the different cultures might cause harm in therapy. I just wondered if you could tell us a bit more about that and what your ideas are about that.
Yeah, I really like Mara Kahn's ideas around this and this kind of idea of attunement, and rather than kind of competence, it's more about how we manage ourselves. And I think a big part of that is humility, willingness to learn away from the client, so we're able to go and kind of learn about things ourselves and not rely on our clients to kind of educate us. And also really recognizing the places where we might have gaps, we might have limitations, And again, it's about not making that the client's problem,
mm-hmm.
you know, not making assumptions in either kind of direction, you know, not assuming that we need to learn something either, you know, and not kind of objectifying a client or reducing a client to an area of their identity.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very, really important, isn't it? Do you find that something that comes up in your, that you do get contacted by people where there has been that sort of cultural misattunement? Or do you find that you tend to attract maybe people more like yourself? Or, you know, tell me a bit more.
Obviously, without talking directly about my clients, there are quite a few people that come to me about harm in therapy where things like racism have been part of their experience of their previous therapy, and then just general othering, really, like othering more generally than just racism. And I think it's, you know, in terms of, do I get clients like me? I do get a lot of autistic clients, and I'm an autistic therapist, and quite often there's been othering around autism as well.
Yeah.
So it is, I think, you know, we only have to look at what few statistics we have. I think there are some statistics somewhere around harm in therapy for marginalised people being mm-hmm. quite a lot more prevalent.
Yeah.
And I think, and also we often don't really know to what level that is true, because a lot of people just simply don't come back to therapy and don't report.
Return.
Marginalised people are less likely to have faith in things like complaint systems
mm-hmm.
for obvious reasons, because systemic oppression is widespread across society, and there's no reason why that wouldn't be any different in a professional body.
Yeah.
So I think it's underreported the extent to which cultural misattunement and also kind of outright, you know, racism, transphobia and all different things along those lines are actually coming up in therapy for clients.
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting point about it can be very difficult for people, say, who've experienced systemic oppression, you know, to then come forward and make a complaint. It's just all part of the same system, isn't it? I think that's a really important point to make. And the fact that, like you say, people just drop off. They'll just say, oh, I tried therapy and it didn't work.
and that's especially the case, I think, because clients are often vulnerable in that they don't know that when it's not their fault.
Yeah.
You know, they don't know that, like I said earlier, clients often go away thinking, I can't do therapy, I'm bad at therapy.
Yeah, or made to feel somehow that they're the one at fault. I think that's been my experience of harm in therapy, was almost like I was the problem.
Yeah. That's unfortunately a really common dynamic, especially in kind of relational harm.
Yeah. So do you think we're doing enough as a profession to acknowledge this? I know there was a big article in BACP earlier this year, and actually, just a couple of days ago, I was reading something in one of the newspapers about people who've been harmed in therapy. But of course, they used a very extreme example. And the example they used was someone who actually wasn't, as far as I could tell, a member of any board, you know, wasn't actually qualified. You know, so that there's that sort of stuff coming up. But do you think we're doing enough to acknowledge it?
I definitely don't think we're doing enough to acknowledge it. I think we have made strides in the last decade, say. Certainly when I first qualified, nobody was even talking about it. And when I started talking about it, I used to get shut down a lot.
Yeah.
I used to have people say to me things like, you're trying to damage the profession.
Yeah.
Why can't you concentrate on the positives?
Yeah.
I would have my own experience denied. So I remember talking about the therapist messaging me in the middle of the night, and someone said, well, his email must have been hacked. Because they couldn't believe that a therapist would do something like that. But actually, you know, there was this kind of collective resistance, I think, to thinking about this and kind of acknowledging that it exists.
Mm.
So I think we are beyond the stage where we're not admitting it exists.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're moving that way anyway, certainly in this country. I think maybe some of the country, like the US, I've noticed it's a bit more patchy, but it's a much bigger place, so it's harder to kind of have cultural movement in a much bigger place.
Mm.
But I think we are making some movement. But I want us to get beyond the stage where we're acknowledging it exists and patting ourselves on the back for doing so.
Yeah.
Because I still think that's not far enough.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, we need to do something about it. Yeah.
Yeah. And one thing that I always really kind of advocate for is not talking about this in terms of bad apples and bad therapists and so we can other the bad therapist and say, yeah, they're over there.
Yeah.
I'm a good therapist. They're a bad therapist.
Yeah.
Actually, the bad therapist thing is a myth, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think much harm in therapy is far more nuanced than this kind of predatory, rarer, but still happens, but rarer kind of predatory, extreme,
like sexual
abusive, like sexual abuse.
Yeah.
And it does happen. And it's a really important aspect of harm in therapy, and it's not one to minimise in any way. But most therapy happens with therapists that have good intentions.
Yeah.
And the reason it's so hard for us to talk about this is because we're so frightened of being the bad therapist. We're so frightened of being named and shamed and put on the website and told we're one of the bad ones.
Yeah.
And that just leaves us unable to, quite often, unable to talk about things that we get wrong in supervision, even, because of the shame and because of the fear.
Yeah.
I heard someone talk about it in terms of feeling like the invisible therapy police are on your shoulder.
Yeah.
You know, and actually that does harm too, because it leads to defensive practice.
Yes.
And defensive practice is that thing where, oh, someone's disclosed to me that they have sexual attraction towards me. I'd better stop letting them email me or something, you know, which isn't practice that centers the client need in that moment, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's just really interesting because I think you're so right in that we like to see ourselves, obviously we call good enough counsellors. We want to see ourselves as good enough, and we don't want to be labelled as a, not good enough, as a bad therapist. And that means that we won't admit the areas perhaps where we may be causing harm, but we maybe struggle to even admit it to ourselves, let alone to bring it to supervision, I think.
Yeah.
And I think there's this whole thing about, like you said, I just thought it was really interesting. It's about the other rather than acknowledging that it can be something that I may make a mistake with. And it's actually unrealistic to think that we're always going to get it right, because it's just, that's not going to happen, is it? So what do you think, this is sort of like a $60 million question, how can we, what sort of practical things can we do to prevent ourselves harming our clients?
So first of all, I think there's two aspects to this.
Mm-hmm.
One is prevention, and the other is what we do with the fact that harm's happened and that harm continues to happen. So I'll start with prevention. I think some of the really kind of simple practical things are around boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about putting a lot of thought into what our boundaries are and why.
Yeah.
I was taught to isn't always a good reason to. I think quite often we need to think a lot more deeply about what clients need and how we're attending to that, and also kind of how that does interact with our ethical frames and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, for example, if a client is going to ask at some point, can I have a hug?
Mm-hmm.
We should already know the answer to that question before they've asked it.
Yeah.
Because what a client doesn't want is a shocked, So I think what we really need to be thinking about is, like, what are our boundaries?
Mm.
If a client does ask for something, if a client does want to email, do we know what our limitations are around that?
Yeah.
Do we know how we're going to handle those questions?
Yeah.
So those are some, like, really simple kind of things that we can just think about in our practice before anything difficult has even happened.
Mm.
And the other thing is, like, collaboration, like the client's right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to be having conversations with the client, not just about boundaries, but about how they're experiencing therapy.
Yeah.
And we need to be really massively open to that,
mm-hmm.
open to feedback, even if it's quite scary for feedback to get because we might have messed up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, we need to be kind of really open to that. And then if a client tells me a way in which I've hurt them or a way in which I've not responded as they hoped I would respond, my job then, I think, is to be really curious about the client's experience.
Yeah.
It isn't to defend myself. It isn't to tell them that's not what I meant. It isn't to, it's really to go, let me really try to understand what that was like for you.
Mm.
And because it's still therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we do with every other aspect of therapy.
Yeah.
We seek to understand the client's experience.
Yeah.
And I don't think that goes away if what the client's experiencing is difficulties in therapy. So I think it's just a real openness to that and knowing what our role is in those moments.
Yeah.
Because they will arise, and they do arise. So
This is sort of staying open and curious, isn't it? It's Black Friday month, and my slightly dodgy maths means that you can still save big with Therapy Growth Group. Get a 4 years membership for just £420 if you're one of the first five people to join, or £540 after that. But be quick, the offer ends on the 30th of November. Join now at josephinehughes.com. So can we talk about supervision and how therapists could use supervision to help them with this sort of aspect of their practice?
Yeah, and I think supervisors do have a role here too, to also be really open and curious. So if a client comes and, if a supervisee comes and says, I think I may have done something harmful here, I think I may have really harmed this client with what I've done, the supervisor needs to be able to make space for the supervisee in that, rather than to admonish them or tell them what they should have done or all those kinds of things, just in a way that really mirrors what I was just saying about how the therapist needs to respond to a client.
Yeah.
It's like, we need to make these conversations safe and possible.
Yeah.
So that they don't get driven underground. I think some of the cases that I've heard about where therapists have, you know, ended up in inappropriate relationships with clients, and they've not ever told their supervisor what's going on.
Mm.
Like they've not even disclosed anything to their supervisor about this client.
Mm.
It's like, how on earth are they supposed to keep any eye on what's happening and the client's well-being and the therapist's well-being if there's no one that they can talk to about it because there's too much shame?
Yeah.
So it's really kind of moving that shame out of the way and allowing just some space to think about what's happening and not panicking when something's going wrong, but really just attending to it in a way that's actually going to be more helpful for clients and the therapist.
And I think this is sort of coming back to what you were saying about the othering, the bad therapist. I think if we can acknowledge that all of us have the potential to harm, sometimes do harm, you know, in a sense that helps to maybe dilute some of that shame, perhaps. If we all acknowledge that this is something that is possible, then it doesn't have to be such a shameful thing to bring to supervision.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
And then the other thing I was just sort of wondering while we were talking about people finding it hard to take things to supervision is really almost sort of like, is there harm in supervision as well as harm in therapy? I don't know what you think about that, because I sometimes wonder, you know, people can be very reluctant to take things to their supervisor. And I just sort of think, oh, you know, I could tell my supervisor anything because I know that really anything goes. I mean, you know, do you think that people get into difficult relationships with supervisors as well as their therapists?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I often have therapists contact me and say, can you say something about harmful supervision? Can you say something about harmful supervision? Because it's something I've experienced a lot.
Yeah.
And we see the same sorts of patterns in terms of marginalised people being disproportionately harmed in supervision. This is obviously anecdotal, but this is what I see. And yeah, it's a significant issue.
It's just absolutely fascinating because, you know, as we're talking, I'm beginning to sort of think of different situations I've been in and things that have happened and how, you know, there might be stuff that's said that's inappropriate and all that sort of stuff.
And, you know, when we talk about, when we talk about client autonomy and how important that is, quite often therapists end up in supervisory relationships that aren't working for them, and because of their employment or whatever else, they can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
And there may be dual relationships that they don't have any say over, so their line manager might be their supervisor and all the difficulties that come along with that. And there's a real autonomy issue there, I think, that we need to think really carefully about, especially because it's such an important relationship in terms of client work. It's and in terms of therapist development too. So I think a lot of thought needs to be put into what say does a supervisee have over what their supervision looks like? And if they don't have a say over it, is that going to be conducive to safe practice?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And again, you know, it comes back to sort of systemic problems within the profession as well, you know, that sometimes people can't afford maybe to talk to a different supervisor, for example, or, you know, because they aren't paid enough to be able to afford to get a second opinion, in a sense. And the whole way that you know, charities are funded and the way that supervision is provided through that as well. So I was wondering, you know, in order to take things to supervision, obviously, as well, I mean, you might have a client that would come to you and say something about how the relationship's going. But if the client doesn't point it out, what do you think the therapists need to look for? How can we, like, notice in ourselves if something's perhaps going wrong?
I always think we need to be attentive. I always think this is a really important question. Am I doing something different with this client to what I do with other clients?
Yeah.
If so, what is the therapeutic reason? It's not always wrong to do something different with one client than we might with a different client. But do we have a therapeutic reason for this? Or is it because this client's my favourite? I want to spend more time with this client. Is it something like that? And we need to be really kind of willing to be honest with ourselves about what's going on.
Yeah.
So I always think that if that is a sign that something's gone awry.
Yeah.
If we are doing something different and we don't know why and we don't have a solid therapeutic reason that we've talked through with a supervisor, then that's something we can attend to. The client may not be able to come and say this is harmful, but a client may be showing distress at the relationship or at the therapy or something that's happening within the therapy. And we should then be really interested and curious in what's happening, both within ourselves in supervision, but also potentially with the client, to try and kind of get to the bottom of what's going wrong if something's going wrong. It's really about maintaining an interest in curiosity in what's happening.
You know, I'm sort of thinking back to myself and the times where, and like yourself, you know, you aren't particularly aware of what therapy should look like. You know, do you think there's anything we can do to help clients know more? this article I read the other day, you know, it was sort of talking about how the therapist exerted so much control over the clients that they began to get really separated from their families and actually grew increasingly dependent on their therapist and increasingly sort of withdrawn and sad. You know, how can we get the message across to people that that isn't what therapy should be like? I don't know.
Yeah, I actually think that clients gaining more information about therapy is really important, which is why it always perturbs me so much when therapists discourage clients from reading and learning more about therapy, because I actually think it's super important that clients are informed about what therapy is and isn't and what it should and shouldn't look like. Incidentally, that dynamic is something that I've heard before. It's like, yeah, that's a kind of dynamic that is common across a lot of different abusive relationships, isn't it, in terms of isolation, alienation and control. Yeah, the other thing I was going to say about that was that there is at the moment a lot of movement in client circles and also in therapist circles internationally to create information, create resource packs for clients, create places where clients can meet other clients. Quite often that attracts clients that have been harmed in therapy, but I think also it's going to be useful for clients that are concerned that they could be harmed in therapy at some time in the future. There's a really brilliant project called Therapy Harm Resistance Project, which is run by Natalie Russ, and she's a therapist based in the US who has a very similar interest to me in harm in therapy, and she does consultation around harm in therapy as I do. And we actually have, together with another therapist, have developed a model of consultation for people that have been harmed in therapy that aren't returning to therapy or that are thinking about returning to therapy. So she has loads of really great resources. She's acquiring new writers all of the time, and that's a Patreon, but it does have free access so that it's accessible for everybody.
Yeah. So it's somewhere that people can find out more about it. So what would you say to clients who've experienced harm and maybe feel scared or reluctant to try again?
It's understandable. I think a lot of people are even in a position of thinking, am I wrong to be feeling this way about going back to therapy? Shouldn't I just get on with it? Shouldn't I just do it? But actually, no, it's a really hard thing to return to therapy. And it's not for everyone. For some people, it might be a really useful thing. And if that's the case, I would just say, take your time looking for a new therapist. It's okay to try different therapists out. It's okay to see where you feel comfortable. It's okay to trust your instinct. It's okay to pause. It's okay to come back. Anything that feels like it might be useful in terms of engaging and and paying attention to engaging and what that feels like is okay. There's no wrong way to go about returning to therapy. It's okay to ask questions. I think people often don't realise that they can ask questions about qualifications and membership bodies and how they work, how they would work with X, Y, and Z, who their supervisor is. We can ask these questions, you know, and if a therapist doesn't want to disclose something, like if a therapist doesn't want to disclose who their supervisor is, if you're not happy with that, you don't have to go back to that therapist.
Yeah.
You know, so it's really just, And obviously for some people, especially people that can't afford private practice, there is no choice. And you may be stuck in a kind of system that's really, that you're finding really harmful and oppressive. And I want to say, it's okay just to walk away from those dynamics when they're harmful. And I'm also aware that that can have repercussions. So I also just want to acknowledge how oppressive the system can be for people that have multiple experiences of harmful therapy and how difficult it can be to return.
Yeah. Are you thinking about particular instances such as, you know, where perhaps the courts have said that you've got to have counselling as part of a mediation dispute or something like that? Or,
well,
you know, impact to social workers, that sort of thing? Or
in that moment, I was thinking about people who are engaging with mental health services who get labelled as non-engaging.
Yeah.
And that limits what further treatment they can have. Of course, I do think there are autonomy issues around mandated therapy generally. And also around therapy that's not mandated, but essentially is, because you can't access other services or medication or whatever else you want unless you engage with something that continues to be harmful. So I think we have all sorts of ethical, I mean, even student therapists, actually, there was some research done into the rates of harm in therapy for therapy students by BPS. I think it was BPS.
A few
years ago. And it found that there were really increased rates of harm in therapy, which they linked to autonomy.
Yeah.
So being kind of mandated to
you have to have therapy.
So I think there's some really, and also it's very difficult to change on some courses if you don't like your therapist.
Yeah.
And also the other thing about that is some courses won't let you continue to see your current therapist and will make you end a helpful therapy relationship and get a new therapist, even if ending that therapy relationship is harmful, which it can be.
So
there are lots of ethical issues around how we think about autonomy in therapy across the board.
Yeah, it's really interesting. When I first started with this therapist, I think she was a tutor, and I'd worked with her as a tutor at a level two or something. And then I went to her when I was on my level three, I think, by which time I wasn't working with her any longer. And then the college actually said, we're just not having this at all. If you're a tutor in our college, you can't see any of our students. But that actually meant we had to end the relationship. That was actually really hard. You know, it's funny. It's just come up for me now, you know, just listening to you there. It can be difficult, can't it? So
it can. There's all sorts of dual relationships are really complicated for that reason in both directions. Actually, it's not just having a dual relationship can be difficult. It's like something ending because it's a dual relationship. Can be really helpful.
Yeah. This is why it's, like you said, it's really good to know what the answers are, in a sense, like the client asking you for a hug. You already know what you're going to say to have sorted in your mind some of those things about dual relationships and boundaries and that sort of stuff before you start. So would you like to see more training and sort of more acknowledgement at the sort of, you know, level three, level four sort of level about harm in therapy?
It definitely, I think, should be embedded into training. It's really difficult because there are hardly any therapists with masses of expertise in it. So it's
you need to write a really book. Difficult.
Yeah, I know. I've been told this many times.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do think that basic information about rates of harm and like you say, things like preventing harm, but also about working with people that have been harmed in therapy, because people often have really difficult experiences of going back. You know, so even just learning about that in training, you know, if someone comes with wanting to talk about therapy harm, it's really important actually that they're given as much space as they need to do that. It's not let's just work through this and we can move on to the real work. Actually, that is the real work at that time.
Yeah.
So just kind of, and not overreacting, not, you know, all these kinds of things that are just can be really important for kind of creating safety for clients going forward. So yeah, I think all of that stuff should be embedded in training.
Yeah.
And I think it should be common in conversations across the profession. I think we should just be talking about this.
Yeah. And somehow making it safe, I think. Because as you say, the shame, just that stigma, is what causes it to get buried. And everybody's too ashamed to admit of anything. And also, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, you'll be well aware of this on some of the social media forums that we have, just how punitive we can be towards each other and how very difficult it is to acknowledge mistakes. And it isn't safe for people then to be able to actually share if they're having problems. Obviously, they wouldn't do that on social media, but, you know, it's just that sort of general feeling.
Yeah, taboo kind of perpetuates taboo, doesn't it? Stigma perpetuates stigma. So there really is something about kind of owning that, you know, harm exists in this profession. Is it possible for any of us to do harm? If we have a long career seeing clients, we probably will do harm at some point.
Yeah.
And it's our job to attend to it, really. Yeah. It's our job to attend to it and look at it and think about it. And we really should be able to do that without being shamed for it.
Yeah. I always remember, you know, making this really awful mistake very early on in a relationship, which meant that the client just cancelled. But, oh gosh, the shame of it was just awful. I felt so bad. You know, I'd sort of thought to myself, well, I think this is a good intervention. It just wasn't. It was wrong. And talking it through, actually, with somebody who was supporting me and them saying, you know, it's really important at this point for you to really, you know, to acknowledge it, to work with it, to examine it so that you can go back. Because this is the sort of thing that could just derail you completely. And I think it's so helpful to be able to get support in that moment when you have made a mistake. And it's really, really helpful to be able to take that to somebody who really gets it. And hopefully that would be obviously your supervisor, you know, so that you can just process it. And it's not making it about your whole practice, is it? It's about, you know, I did make a mistake, but that doesn't mean that, you know, I'm universally a bad therapist. It's like, it's just part of what I've done. I've made a mistake, but that's okay. I mean, you know, to a certain extent, it's about recovery.
And also, sometimes I think the hardest things for people to bring to supervision are not just like a mistake, but also this therapy's out of control. Right. I'm out of my depth.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm doing with this client. It's too enmeshed. It's too difficult. I'm confused. I'm lost. And then that becomes too big a thing to talk about. And then it can just spiral and get worse and worse. So I would really encourage therapists who find themselves in that position, because there will be therapists who find themselves, probably even therapists listening to this, that have found themselves in that position with clients where they're like, I really don't know what to do here. I'm completely out of my depth here. I don't know what's going on. To really find a supportive space to talk about that. One that's not going to say, you terrible therapist, how dare you, but one that's going to say, well, let's understand what's going on. Let's try and get you back on track. Let's try and get your feet back on the ground
in
this relationship and figure out what to do next.
Yeah.
And that's actually really helpful for the therapist and really helpful for the client.
Yeah. And just sort of putting myself in the feet of maybe the supervisor as well. And because you're a supervisor, aren't you? Quite a scary place for a supervisor to be and for a supervisor to hear as well.
I think it can be, because I don't find it that scary, but I think I'm in an unusual position of hearing lots and lots and lots of different cases where things like this have happened. So it doesn't feel out of the ordinary for me in a way that it might for supervisors. But also, you know, we have supervision on our supervision, you know, we can share this, we can think about this and kind of be mutually supportive. And I think we sometimes just need to remember that this, what we're talking about here, is like a relational harm or a relational entanglement or a relational difficulty. And we know about relationships. We know about relational entanglements. We just need to slow down sometimes, I think, and really just try to understand what's happening so we can figure out the best way forward. And so that means remembering what we know, actually, sometimes.
Yeah.
Rather than fearing what might happen.
Yeah. So I was just sort of wondering, you know, as we sort of, the time is just like, I can't believe how quickly time's gone.
Yeah.
If there's anybody here, I suppose there might be sort of two types of listener. You know, there could be the therapist who's sort of in a situation where they think they are, you know, have caused harm or are in the process of being in a sort of harmful therapeutic relationship with a client. But there also might be clients who are listening as well. So I wondered if, you know, we could just sort of think about, what would you say to a therapist who's worried that they might be in a situation where they're causing harm?
I think what I would say is, I recognise that it's scary, mm-hmm. and I recognise that it's very difficult to talk about this, and it's also super important to find that supportive space. It's we don't have to do this by ourselves.
Yeah.
If we found ourselves in that situation, it's going to be in the interests of you and also your client to find a container for this again. If it's become mm-hmm. uncontained, let's find a container, and that's likely to be supervision or consultation or something like that.
Mm.
But if we can find ourselves in a position where we can be curious about what's happening, we can recenter ourselves on what the client is experiencing and work with the client as much as we can to change the direction of what's happening, it's much less likely to be a kind of traumatic outcome
mm-hmm.
than it is if we just kind of try and go alone and not
confront it, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And how about, because, you know, obviously there probably are people listening who maybe, you know, listening to you and listening to some of the stuff you've said, have actually begun to recognise that perhaps they're in a relationship with a therapist that's causing them harm. What would you say to them?
Well, not dissimilar, actually. You know, this is something that is not uncommon, and that it's okay to talk about. It's okay to talk about it with a trusted person.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few of us therapists that do consultation around this,
mm-hmm.
and if it feels safe to talk to the therapist about it, that's an option. It's also okay to leave
mm-hmm.
if you're in a situation where you feel as though there's not going to be a resolution, or where it will become harmful, or you've tried to talk before and it's not working. You're not obliged to kind of stay and work through it. I think a lot of people talk about, you need to stay and work through it because this is where the work is.
Yeah.
Actually, sometimes if it's become really stuck, that might not be the case.
Yeah.
Whatever you decide to do is okay. It's mm-hmm. And also, I'm just really sorry that it's happening, because mm. it's a really difficult, painful and frightening thing to go through as a client.
Thank you, Erin. So tell us a bit more about, so you've mentioned consultation sessions. Is this for clients who think they might have been harmed?
So I do both. There's a group of us therapists, there's three of us actually, that have developed this model of consultation, which is 1-3 session with clients, where clients can come and talk through what's happened. Quite often they might be making decisions. Do I want to return to therapy?
Mm-hmm.
Do I want to make a complaint?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's just help me understand whether or not this was harmful. Whatever it is that they need to talk through. When I started doing short-term consultation, it was mostly because I didn't have any space for long-term work.
Yeah.
And I knew I was getting a lot of inquiries. And so I thought, well, if I do this, then at least I'll be able to offer something.
Yeah.
But actually what I found is, for some people, especially people that don't want to return to therapy because it's been so harmful,
mm-hmm.
it's a really useful to have this thing where they know where it's going to end.
Mm-hmm.
They know that they're not going to become attached because it's so short-term.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that it's this contained thing, and we know what it is, and we know when it will end, and it's all contracted.
Yeah.
And so I found it can be a really useful space for a lot of people. I also do consultation with therapists, which, you know, is essentially kind of supervision, but it might just be a kind of one-off
mm-hmm.
where they want to talk through something that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes therapists just want to come and talk to me about harm in general, which is also fine.
Yeah.
I'm open to kind of any kind of consultation around this stuff.
Yeah, really useful. My neurons firing. It's about to take you off on a whole other little journey. We'll have to come back to it, I think. And you do training as well around harm in therapy, don't you?
Yeah, so I did a few workshops earlier this year, actually, mm-hmm. Some of which are available on my website, one of which was a talk with Natalie Russ of the mm-hmm. Therapy Harm Resistance Project, which mm-hmm. is on YouTube, just really kind of exploring some of the areas. So I did one with Sunny Hallett, talking about queer and neurodivergent experiences of harm in therapy, did one on rupture repair,
mm-hmm.
and one just kind of generally about working with clients that have had previous experiences of harm in therapy. I always do a guest lecture at Leeds Uni every year. It's down the road from me. And I'm open to other kind of training opportunities as well, sort of time permitting.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And if people want to find out about them, can you just remind us of your website address?
Yeah, so it's www.erinstevens.co.uk.
Brilliant. Erin, honestly, as I said, I mean, you just touched on it then. I started thinking about LGBTQ people and, you know, their experience of harm in therapy. Perhaps we'll have to do that another time.
Yeah. There's always so much to say, isn't there?
It's fantastic. Thank you so much. I think we've just sort of like just scraped the surface, really, of all your knowledge. Mm. But thank you so much for being here and sharing with us. And obviously people can follow you up if they need more support. So thank you for that. Thanks for coming along.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been lovely to talk.
Oh, it's been amazing. Thank you. Thanks for listening. Do come and join my Facebook community, Good Enough Counsellors. And for more information about how I can help you develop your private practice, please visit my website, josephinehughes.com. If you found this episode helpful, I'd love it if you could share it with a fellow therapist or leave a review on your podcast app. And in closing, I'd love to remind you that every single step you make gets you closer to your dream. I really believe you can do it.